Hello, this is Eric Morris Eskenazi. Thanks for tuning in to this latest episode of the Erratic Dispatches podcast. For this episode, I am interviewing writer Maggie Dwyer, discussing her novel, What the Living Do.
Hello, thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break.
So, Maggie, can you start by talking about your writing background and how you started writing and what are some of your literary inspirations?
I guess I kind of always wanted to be a writer. Mm-hmm. In a way, I kind of relate it back to childhood games I play with my older sister. When she played herself as she was and as Big Mary, and I had to play all the other parts. And then, you know, I loved Little Women. The character Joe was a writer. Mm-hmm. These are the sort of things. But I didn't really start writing until probably I was mid-30s.
Okay.
I was chumming around with a lot of people, and I just didn't feel like it was there. So that's mm-hmm. when I started writing short fiction in mm-hmm. my 30s. And I had the good fortune, when living in Winnipeg then, got new neighbors next door. Turned out to be Carol Shields. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with mm-hmm. her work.
Yeah, I've heard her, uh-huh.
Yeah, anyway, so Carol was my next door neighbor, and I got involved with Winnipeg has a very vibrant art scene, and they had a writer's guild, so I got involved with that group. And I did do a few, you know, workshops, and my marriage broke up, and I was back at university, and I took creative writing with the poet Georgia Mobley, mm-hmm. Just as a course. And then I just started, you know, slowly working at it. And I published a volume of short stories before the novel that you're familiar with, mm-hmm. With Turnstone in Winnipeg, and, you know, just kept on from there. Mm-hmm. Because I think at one point, Carol came over and she asked me to witness a contract for a book she was about to publish. And I thought to myself, you know, if you don't, you know, do this, you're gonna hate yourself later on if you don't give it a shot. So I did, and you know, keep on with it. Mm-hmm. I guess that would be it. And I mean, certainly her work was an influence, but I really read, I guess if I turn this way, you can see my mm-hmm. library of short story writers. Mm-hmm. And I think the people who influenced me in writing Canadians, speaking about mm-hmm. Canadians, would be Alice Munro and Mavis Gallant.
Okay.
Possibly you don't know her. She moved from Montreal in about 1952 to Paris, just determined to make it, and The New Yorker published almost all her work. Wonderful stories, but she's not even that well known in Canada because a lot of her work is set in Paris, France, in Europe, mm-hmm. but it's really a good sense of humor, which is something I admire in writing. Mm-hmm. Trying to think other influences. I read a lot of poetry, and I think that somewhat influences my work. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of what you're looking for?
Sure, yeah. Have you published or written poetry?
No. I think the very first short story I published had a poem in it, but it was terrible. I just, mm-hmm. you know, I don't do poetry.
Okay.
Just haven't got it.
Okay. So for your novel, What the Living Do, how long did you work on it for?
Well, two sections. I started on it maybe in the early 2002, somewhere in there. And at that point, I had an agent. Tragedy occurred in her life. And she said, well, you know, I don't think I can represent you. You know, your work is too sad. Anyway, she eventually left the business. It went out, but it was too early. So then it was in the drawer for probably, 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then I got it out again and worked on it again. And I went with self-publishing because at this stage of the game, and given what's happening in publishing these days, I thought, you know, who knows if I would ever find another agent. You know, it's such a procedure, and you know, there are trends in mm-hmm. publishing. I didn't think my work matched anything that was out there. So I just thought, I'll go with Freezins, and they were tremendous. would highly recommend them. So that's how I ended up going with self-publishing.
So you published the novel yourself, so you didn't go through a small publisher, like an independent publisher?
I just didn't want to bother with that scene, so I just thought, what the heck? And so far, you know, I mean, when you go with self-publishing, you're not eligible for a lot of competitions, but I did get 3 stickers.
Yeah, I saw that on your website that your novel was a winner of the Canadian Book Club Awards for Fiction, shortlisted for the Whistler Independent Book Award of 2019, and the finalist for the 2020 Next Generation Indie Book Award. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, not bad for self-publishing. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a million seller. I'm not looking for that. Mm-hmm. I've really just, you know, these characters in the interim period where I wasn't working on that manuscript, you know, you can't get them out of your head. You'll be working on something else, and then you'll go like, oh. And then you just have to, you have to get rid of those people.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they're occupying too much space. And you can't sort of move. I found I couldn't really move forward all that well with something else. I'm probably not going to be the kind of writer whose stuff is, make it a bestseller list. The novel I'm working on now is certainly probably not going to be there either, but that's okay. I really don't care. I'm writing just because I want to.
Mm-hmm. Do you write full time?
I'm retired now. I mean, okay. I can write whenever I want. Mm-hmm. I won't say I'm writing full time in the most recent months, but I certainly could. That's all I do, creatively, is write.
I found a couple
of short stories. I thought, well, maybe because I published excerpts from the novel in other media, and one was a short listed for the, what's it called? The Gloria Vanderbilt Prize, the Cooper Prize, Cooper v. Cooper. Prize that's got runs by Exile Publications, or do you know Exile out of Toronto, out of Montforest?
Mm-mm.
Anyway, it's a wonderful quarterly magazine, beautifully produced, and they have some relationship, originally with Gloria Vanderbilt, but since she died, I think now Anderson Cooper has taken over. Oh. They run this annual fiction and poetry competition every year for Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
So. The excerpt, remember the part about Paul Boudreaux? There's sort of a self-contained chapter where he's introduced and his whole story about what happened and how he's holed up in her apartment.
Mm-hmm.
That was excerpted as a story.
Wow.
So I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll just do another book of stories. So I wrote a couple more, but so far I haven't got enough for any kind of collection.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe then I'll go back to a, you know, small house, small publishing house, and see.
So in your novel, I found it was really fascinating, like the juxtaposition of like Georgia Lee K. Stern's, like her adoptive family being Jewish, and then the Cree Indian Native American family. So when you talk about the juxtaposition of the different traditions, like how they want her funeral to be, in the different conflicts with that. So in Canada, is Cree like a large tribe within Canada?
Oh, yes. The Cree Nation is huge. Mm-hmm. And it's mainly, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, lots of Cree people, and particularly in the north. Now, my background originally, my original education is in nursing. And maybe that's what spurred me to get back to it, because I had, as I said, gone back to university, enhanced my studies, and then I got a job. Well, the last job I had was I was a medical examiner's investigator, which is a position that they have in just 3 of the Canadian provinces, where you're a coroner's assistant. And I would get called out, you know, to see death scenes, and you sort of do the first assessment. And because I was kind of fascinated in Ontario, not so much now, but certainly when I was growing up, Native people were just invisible. I mean, I knew at Brantford there was a big reserve and the Six Nations, that's the home of the Six Nations. You just didn't see them. I never knew anybody until I moved to Winnipeg, because that has the highest population of Aboriginals in the city and of anywhere in Canada. And I got to know, you know, Aboriginal people. And so I was sort of fascinated with that whole story, because all the Manitoba, there's one big center, Winnipeg, which is about 800,000 people. Everything else is a town or a village. I think the next biggest city is 50,000. So everybody who needs healthcare has to come to Winnipeg. From the Inuit population or the Cree, the various Native people that are in the, because if you look at the map of Manitoba, north of the lakes, there's just very little. And it's all fly-in communities. And I knew socially two or three families who had adopted a Native child, and the subsequent difficulties that they came upon when the teenage years in particular. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't know anyone who tried to do what the mother in my story did, was to sort of pretend that this was her baby. Mm-hmm. Because she wasn't able to have children, and to, you know, the sort of notion that she could carry it through, and maybe, and I think sometimes people do that, but typically if there's any physical indications of a mixed race, and mixed race has to be one of the most interesting questions that we're dealing with in society right now. Because more and more people are mixed race. Just read a fascinating article about the term Latinx, which is the new word that some Latinos are using. Latinas, Latinos, Latinx. We're all trying to find our place in the world, like Georgia Lee did. Also, I was interested in the relationship with the sisters, but mainly this whole notion of what to do, what these two small sort of, in a way, stigmatized communities, or could be stigmatized communities, the Jewish community and the Native community. So it was just something that was sitting with me, and I, you know, looked to find a way to talk about it. Three of my five beautiful grandchildren are mixed. So, of course, I'm concerned about their future, concerned about the world that they're going to be growing up in. The eldest is now 8. Just it's a, you know, the world is so fraught now on these questions of race, particularly in the last, I don't imagine you're a Trump supporter, but
no, definitely not.
I didn't think so. But, you know, since in the past 4 years of his administration, there seemed to be far more, or we're hearing more, divisiveness and just ugly talk.
A lot of more anti-Semitism, a lot of more anti-Semitism going on too, you know, in the U.S.
Yes.
It's very scary. Like I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I live in a neighborhood that has a large community of Orthodox Jews. You know, I come from a secular background, but I feel safer living in a Jewish community than I did in other neighborhoods, you know, or other areas of the country where, like, I recently grew up in Southern California in Orange County, which is like very ultra right wing, you know, and there was there still is like a large, like there's kind of neo-Nazis there, people, there are Trump supporters there. And I thank God that I don't live in that community anymore, because I would feel like threatened,
right?
You know, or I would have to hide my identity, not tell people that I'm Jewish, because I'm afraid that people would, you know, say things. So it's scary, you know, with Trump, you know, these past 4 years. But luckily, you know, in my neighborhood, I haven't noticed or I haven't heard about any attacks. Other neighborhoods north of me, there have been, you know, Jewish, like Orthodox Jews versus, you know, people visibly Orthodox, you know, with the kippahs and everything. Mm-hmm. They get people like will smack them and throw rocks at them, and, you know, I hear all kinds of stuff happening. It's, you know, it's horrible.
It is horrible. And you think, you know, this starts in the home. Where else could it? I mean, sometimes later people, you know, embrace these ideas, but typically it starts in the home.
Is there like a vibrant Jewish community where you live in Canada?
No. I live in a rural area. There's like nobody. I mean, okay. I have a few friends mm-hmm. in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. You have to go to a bigger city. I mean,
like Toronto.
Toronto, sure. Mm-hmm. Winnipeg, huge. You know, I had in my first marriage converted mm-hmm. and, you know, became very involved mm-hmm. in the Jewish community in Winnipeg just because, you know, it's the whole art scene mm-hmm. and it was just very warm and welcoming when I moved there. But, there's very vibrant scenes in Toronto, but I mean, there is a tiny little synagogue in North Bay, which is the nearest place, but you know, they don't keep a rabbi. I think they do something for the holidays, but it's very small scale. People sort of, I mean, there are traditions locally of people who will just hold a Seder. Mm-hmm. We had to do ours on Zoom this year, but mm-hmm. it's okay.
Yeah. So with your experience, you were working as a medical examiner. So that's how you got like a lot of the terminology you used in your novel, you know, like forensics and stuff, you know, when
the forensics,
like yeah. examining the bodies in the morgue. And
yeah, no, we, I did all of that. Mm-hmm. And that led to me. My office sent me on a course to the American Institute of Forensic Pathology in Washington. I think it was 1997. And that's how I met my second husband, who was a dentist who did dental forensics. And he lived on Vancouver Island. So then I up stakes, got married to him and moved out to the West Coast for about a dozen years. And now we've moved back. But yeah, though, that's where I came up with all the forensic stuff.
Oh. And in the novel, there's that whole... I'm sorry.
Pardon me. I was just going to say I attended many autopsies.
Wow. And were you like influenced by the crime genre, any crime writers when you're writing the novel?
Well, as I said in the epigraph, P.D. Mm-hmm. James, really, that was, she's a writer whose work I mm-hmm. really do admire. I've read, you know, quite a bit. I like Peter Robinson, Rebus. I'm thinking of the writer right now. But yeah, no, I like it. But the idea for me in the novel was the question about the quote from P.D. James where she says, you know, murder is a contaminating crime. And it touches and influences everybody that mm-hmm. comes in contact. And that was my reason for including all these characters to say what happens to people. Because, you know, you'll read in the paper some dreadful, you know, murder and then you're thinking, well, you know, what happens to the first person who, you know, has found the body and blah, blah, blah. What is it? What is the fallout from that? I think that was kind of one of the things that fascinated me, because as a medical examiner's investigator, you know, you would prep the case and bring it to the medical examiner. I mean, obviously any murder is going to have an autopsy. Where was I going with that? Okay, so you are used to seeing all these things, but it's some of them, just as you see, and it, you know, it's so sort of stereotypical when you think of how every policeman has these cases that they just can't let go of, they can't forget. And that's why some of these things stick with you. I'm not haunted by things that I saw, but just more or less the people. And we were the ones who would then be dealing with the families, the investigators, you know, calling up. And, you know, some of the scenes that are in the novel were influenced or, you know, sort of, I took some material and, you know, switched it up so it wouldn't be recognized. You know, the idea of how people take the news. Sometimes you have to break the news to people. No, I'm sorry, you can't see your loved one just now. Try to remember them as they were. Because, you know, either their body was just not viewable mm-hmm. or whatever reason. But a lot of things really just sort of stuck with you. Like in the novel, there's a little tiny scene where Maude takes the Granny Spence and Brenda to the morgue to see the baby, see Georgia Lee's body. And they talk about the dew that's, or the tear, you know, it looks like teardrops. I actually had that experience going with some people to show them the body, and you would prep them, put the body in a bed and try and make it look, you know, like they were sort of just sleeping or they're. So, you know, things like that stay with you. And that's the way I can deal with it, is to write about it, somehow shaping it a little differently. So it would make sense in the flow of things. And also that year, 1997, was the year of the flood of the century in Manitoba, which, you know, was a real thing. And so that was coloring that. That was the last full year that I lived. I left Manitoba in July of 98. So that was the last full year I lived there. And you know, everyone was caught up in the flood preparations. So that was a, you know, just seemed to be the right background. And then I thought, how to organize it, so I did it by dates, because that seemed easy.
Yeah, I really found that fascinating with your novel that you included that. So I didn't know that was historic, that was actually that actually happened.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah, it was, I mean, I was living in a second floor apartment, so I had no problems, but yeah, no. A lot of the stuff was sort of, you know, things that I knew about that people were doing to prepare and were happening currently. But, you know, they have now the big floodgates. So in the end, they opened the floodgates. The water went around the city, sacrificing a little community at the south end. But what can you do? Mother Nature will have her way.
How's the public reaction been so far to your novel?
Very, well, you know, a lot of positive feedback. And I mean, even from people who aren't, you know, related. Or, you know, whatever. A lot of people have enjoyed it and enjoyed the story. I had a book launch in Winnipeg because the McNally Robinson, which is a wonderful bookseller there, independent, organized that for me. And yeah, so it was well received in Winnipeg. And, you know, I thought, what can I do to sort of spread the word? So I actually did send copies out to libraries across the country. And to see, you know, maybe they'll take it up, because it's difficult to, and actually essentially impossible to get a bookstore to stock your book if it's self-published. I mean, you can buy it from Friesen's, and I think the Canadian chain Indigo has it, but just, you know, they always want it to be easy. And even if you buy book return insurance, which I did, it's still not easy to talk people into it.
Well, before the shutdown, but were you? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was saying before the shutdown to COVID, were you able to do any like live readings from the book?
Not since the shutdown. I haven't done anything.
So you haven't done like any readings online either?
No, and I should. I'm just, you know, I mean, there's a lot more I could do. I just haven't done it. Readings on, yeah, no, I should be doing readings online. And I had thought of that actually, even with the short fiction, to read them. And there's a guy with a recording studio nearby. I could do that. I just have to make the time. Don't pay enough attention to it.
Is there an audiobook version available for What the Living Do?
No, and I don't know how to get that. I mean, you know, you can write to audible.com or whatever they are, but I just haven't made that connection yet either. But I mean, I think it would be good. The thing with Audible books is you have to have the right reader. I mean, I love Richard Ford's work, for example, and I was in Mexico and I bought, downloaded a recording of the short stories, the first one. And, but the reader was terrible. I just couldn't listen to it because I really like, you know, if you know the writer's voice, if you've ever heard them interview, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
But I think it would be good. And maybe I'll get off my, you know, chair and do something about it.
Hello. Thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break.
So tell me about your short story collection, Misplaced Love. Was that stories even you had been working on for, I guess, for a while, like over a decade or so?
Oh, probably. I can't even tell you. This is the book. Mm-hmm. The illustration is something I have two nieces who are illustrators. But yeah, they're sort of stories. It's a mixed bag of things. But in each of them, there's sort of stories where somebody is with the wrong person somehow. Yeah. It's funny, I haven't looked at it in quite a while. I was influenced. One of my big literary influences, or person, someone whose writing I very much advise, of course, would be Chekhov. Mm-hmm. So one of the stories I wrote was sort of a response to called Once More with Feeling. It was sort of a response to the story, The Lady with the Pet Dog. And it's about these two elderly Jewish people who are having an affair. When I first went to Winnipeg, because then I wasn't working outside the home, I had two small girls, and I was asked to go up to the North End, and there was a Jewish seniors group there, and they were sponsored by the National Council of Jewish Women and all that, but the president, who had been in for a long time, he didn't want to resign. He was kind of refusing to resign. And so they had to tell them, look, you know, you need to have a constitution. So I had to work with them all through that process of setting up their constitution and figuring out. So I got quite involved with a lot of elderly Jewish people then. And some of them were inspirations for the stories in that collection. Wow. It was really hilarious at times.
So you said you're currently working on a new project. Is it a novel, or is it like another collection of stories?
Right now, the big project is a novel, which would be set in Ontario, near Stratford, Ontario.
Okay.
In about the 1930s, maybe around 1932. That's the area where my family came, when they came out from Ireland. They settled there in the mid-19th century. And there's a place there called the Yellow Swamp, and that's where one of the characters will find a body of a girl who disappeared in about 1895. Someone had come to cut the turf. This fellow had, and that's, he was a survivor of the, did you know there was a tsunami in Newfoundland?
No.
Yeah, 1918, October of 1918, there was a tsunami. It was an offshore earthquake, and then the tsunami wiped out these little communities at the south part of Newfoundland, and nobody even heard about it for days because they were cut off, by radio, etc. And they were all outports. We were only accessible by water anyway. So one of the survivors of that comes to Ontario. And he decides he's going to try and set up a business where he would be cutting peat from this. And that's how he discovers the body. But I wanted that one. That one will probably, again, be about sisters. Mm-hmm. You know, like Burl and Rona were not sisters who got along at all. I have had five sisters. We're very close. So the whole sisterly relationships fascinate me. And that's going to be kind of at the core of the book. The sisters will be much nicer to each other.
Do you mind sharing, what are the biggest challenges and joys of being a writer?
I think one of the biggest challenges is sitting down and actually doing it. You know, you have to really, when it's really cooking, you really have to be at it every day. I think when I was writing short stories, I could start and reread every time I went to work on it. I could reread the whole thing. Writing a novel, it's more difficult because it's a huge project. I, compare it to, you know, trying to build a skyscraper with a paper and pencil. But I think really one of the main challenges, once you've found what you want to say or what you want to write about, and it doesn't, you know, always, the shape doesn't always turn out, you know, as you probably know from speaking with other writers or if you write yourself, sometimes things, you know, just think, oh, no, that's not working. I'm going to change it all up. But it's fun. Mm-hmm. But I think really just the self-discipline, mm-hmm, to sit down and do it. And you have to just sort of decide, well, I'm going to write it this way. I don't, you know, it's probably not going to be a bestseller. That's okay. I'm writing what I'm writing. Maybe it'll catch on. Maybe it won't. But I think that's it. And just, you know, like at this stage of the game, I have lots of time to write. Mm-hmm. Especially now during this pandemic.
Yeah.
And I've been going through trunks of, I was organizing, I ended up with the family archives, which my mother had been keeping. So now I inherited them. And I also had the habit of keeping all the letters I ever received since I left home. And I was going through all these trunks of old letters and cards, and it evoked a lot of memories and, you know, just thinking about stages of life, what's going on. And then you can decide, you know, what is the question? You know, maybe you sort of, there's a question that you want an answer for. And if you can sort of suspend it in the, you know, in the air and give those concerns to other people and then write out how they might deal with things. It's interesting, challenging, can be frustrating, but I like it.
Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning before about Winnipeg as a big like art scene.
Oh, yes. And I was going to ask you, mm-hmm, I was going to suggest, my younger daughter, Sylvia Matus, mm-hmm, is a visual artist.
Oh, okay.
And you might be interested in looking at her work. If you look at sylviamatus.com, you can see her work. She does mostly drawings and videos, but there's a huge art scene in Winnipeg. They, I mean, for a city of, you know, 750,000, to have a symphony orchestra, ballet, opera, and I think when I was there, there were, well, I'm not sure now, there were 5 or 6 live theaters, I mean, companies. It always has had that vibe. The North End, of course, where all the Jews went. Mm-hmm. Not that they're all there now, but that was sort of it. And they started, you know, with the Workman's Benevolent Circle, mm-hmm, dramatic, mm-hmm, things. So, yeah, no, it's very good. One thing I do miss about, you know, when I left Winnipeg was that scene. And, of course, all my friends, tons of writers and poets, amazing.
Now, you're probably familiar with what's an experimental filmmaker? What's his name, Guy Madden?
Oh, Guy Madden, yeah.
Yeah, because he's done films about Winnipeg.
I shouldn't say that.
My Winnipeg, I think, you ever see that film he did? He talked about, like, his childhood there.
Oh, yeah.
He uses a lot of archival, like, it's funny, he uses archival footage and the new footage, and I enjoy his work. Like,
yeah, no, his whole story about his mother being a hairdresser, and they lived over the shop, and dad was, mm-hmm, a NHL hockey referee. Oh, yeah, no, Guy Madden's big on the scene in Winnipeg, and yeah, no, I've seen all his stuff. Mm-hmm. I think when I was at university in the late 80s, his collaborator, George Tolles, was my prof for film studies. And so we saw, like, his first film, The Dead Father, in class, when it was sort of just, hadn't really been put out there yet. He was just looking for comments on it. So yeah, no, Guy's really, really funny.
Oh, you mentioned before about
lots of other ones and tons of actors.
Oh, from Winnipeg? Yeah.
And writers. And a lot of them went on to Stratford.
Okay.
They had a wonderful theater scene with Shakespearean plays for a while. There's the monastery that I mentioned in the story where the couple go, mm-hmm, Georgia Lee and Paul go, that monastery. That's, I think, it's still used for what they call pantomime performances. And the actors who were not so busy in the summertime because, you know, the theater season was finished, they decided to do these pantomime performances where it was a very small audience and you would follow the players from area to area of this scene. And I saw wonderful productions of like Twelfth Night, there's, you know, where they had Titania come on a raft and walk up out of the river, and Lady Macbeth go down and wash her hands in the river. Lots of talent and a really quite interesting, you know, productions.
Wow.
Yeah. It's worth looking into, Eric. That's what I'm saying about Winnipeg.
I've never been to Canada, but my mom, like, we've been doing some sort of, like, background, our family, like, genealogy background. So I know that we had relatives that were from Canada. I don't know if I have any surviving family up there or not, but I've always wanted to go. I hope to go at some point.
Yeah, you should. Well, yeah. when you know, people are able to travel again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I'll check it out.
Yeah, that will be something.
You mentioned before about Sylvia's website. How do you spell her last name?
Sylvia, Sylvia.
Okay.
Matas.
Okay. I'll definitely check it out.
.com. Yeah.
Okay, great.
And her work is interesting. And of course, I'm her mother. What can I say?
Mm-hmm.
She's done fairly well. She's working on a drawing collection now, I think. But she's had, you know, reasonable success for someone in the artistic community.
Great. That's excellent. Maggie, do you mind sharing, like, any interesting stories, that inspired you as you were writing your novel, What the Living Do?
Not sure exactly what you're looking for, Eric.
Well, just in regards to your research or anything that inspired
Well, the characters, you see, sometimes what I do is if I can see the character, and of course, people like Paul Boudreau, I met this type of person when I was working I worked in the intensive care and the forensic side. So I was familiar with these kind of people. He's a composite. I remember going, one of the first cases that I went to when we were doing the forensic, when I started in the forensic side, medical examiner took a bunch of us out to the scene where in the novel it's described where Paul ditches his car on the big highway divide out near Richard. And I can remember going there and a fellow, this really horrid person, had taken these teenagers. He was offering them drugs, and of course they're young, you know, rootless kids, went along with it, and he would tie them up and they would make them perform various sex acts and stuff. And one fellow actually escaped and crawled out to the highway, flagged people down, and that's how they found out about this site, and eventually they captured him. But we went out to look at this site, and the police were there sifting through the remains. Or not remains, but we found some bones, and they were sifting through, and they found these little pink fingernails. The girl who had been killed and left her body in the woods, and it wasn't a whole lot left other than skeletal remains, but these little pink fingernails, you know, just sort of stuck with me. And, you know, you're thinking, What happened? How could she get so badly mixed up? There's really been a huge commission in Canada. I don't know if you're aware of the missing and murdered Indigenous women, because there have been, you know, sort of like the Blacks being shot by the police in the States, the Native people in Canada badly treated. A lot of women have gone missing. There's a place in BC, in the north of BC, a highway called the Highway of Tears. A lot of these little communities, you see, there's no real transportation, maybe bus once a day or something. If you don't have a car, a lot of people hitchhike. A lot of people just disappeared, and it's just so heartbreaking for the families. You just can't imagine. There was a recent case in Winnipeg. This girl of 15 was found in the river. This was after I left, but I can really just sort of visualize the whole scene. She was wrapped up in a duvet. Now, somebody knows who put Tina Sinclair in the river. And they did charge somebody, but it was all circumstantial. The duvet that she was wrapped in was very similar to one that this person was known to have in his room. Somebody knows something. And you just think, how can you live with yourself? if you don't come forward? Or, you know, how can you deny that you did it? You know, you're just so rotten to the core. So it's a haunting thing to think of all these cases where people have just essentially evaporated. Families are distraught. There's just a sort of, you know, I mean, it's horrible to lose a child to some sort of sickness, pain that just doesn't quit. But, you know, if it's when they've just vanished, that's really, you know, it really haunted me, cases like that.
Was there ever, had there been any like a history of like hate crimes against Native people in Canada?
Well, I don't know if you can say hate crimes. Certainly, they've been slighted. I don't know about hate crimes, and there have been some convictions that were overturned when you know, they were just. Sometimes the police get this tunnel vision, and they don't investigate other leads. They just decide it was so-and-so. And maybe they have something in their background that leads everybody to think that, yeah, they could have done it. Yeah, they've done some, you know, not similar, but, you know, they're the violent type. But it's just, you know, I became very sympathetic after I got to know some Native people in Winnipeg, because you can see it's very, very hard. And I think that I mentioned in the book, how Waylon is in the city doing his carpenter's apprenticeship. When I was between jobs one year, I was someone who went and interviewed people at the food banks. And it was a bitter winter, I think, 93. And of course, you see, sometimes in these Native communities, which are very isolated, there's either hereditary leadership, hereditary chiefs, or someone's voted in. And if you don't get along with them, you're not going to get much even within that community. And those people would come to Winnipeg. What we were doing, this study was looking at people who were on, you know, relief, on welfare, as it were coming to the food banks in droves, because, of course, they would take as much as they could of their issue to secure a nice place to live, a place where they felt safe. So then they wouldn't be sufficient for food. So they have to go to the food banks. And met a lot of people when doing that survey too. But, you know, their experiences just sort of resonated with me. I've been most fortunate in my life. I guess I'm a, you know, white privilege. Everything that goes with that. I never actually have been... insulted or had any issues around my being Jewish. So that was good. I mean, you mentioned yourself how you feel safer in the community that you live in. Then, but I mean, I, you know, I don't have anything about my physical appearance. I don't think most people, and my name, people don't say, oh, she's Jewish, right? You know, I'm not Hedy Stein or something, but it's not easy. As I say, race is a question that now I think is one of the main ones facing us on this planet. What are we going to do about it? Because every year there are more and more, there's more and more mixing, and maybe that's the answer.
Yeah.
If you, I don't know, but it sure is a big problem for us humans.
Yeah, unfortunately, people suck. They waste too much time, you know, with the prejudice.
Yeah. And it just doesn't make any sense, you know?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what group you belong to, people, you have to find out what people have to give.
Yeah.
What their contributions are.
True.
Could be, that is.
Maggie,
everybody's reading. BIPOC writers now, and James Baldwin, when I was a teenager, is really making it, and I'm glad, because I think his work is wonderful. That there's some kind of resurgence and interest in it.
Yeah. We're trying to
and tragic too that the guy who played the Black Panther, Boisman, you know, fell ill, and because he was a real hero, I think, to a lot of young black people.
Right. Yeah.
The first black superhero.
Yeah. I guess, did you have, like, in Canada, were there any rioting going on up there? No. You don't have, yeah, that's good, because we had a lot of it here. I mean, in my neighborhood.
I mean, there have been
demonstrations. Go ahead. No, you were saying there's been demonstrations.
I was just going to say, well, there's been some of this knocking over statues, particularly our first Prime Minister, Macdonald, because he was one of the architects of the residential school situation where these kids were taken from them, from their homes. And yeah, no, I met a lot of those kids. Mm-hmm. Native Canadians and also Inuit. In my work. Yeah. It's very moving, you know, it's very concerning.
Yeah, we didn't have any.
What are you going to say, Eric?
Oh, I was just saying we didn't have any rioting in my neighborhood back, you know, like a few months ago. But other parts of Brooklyn, there was, like, you know, stuff going on, like, all the time. And then, like, you know, people were smashing storefronts a lot. And now, like, there's buildings or, you know, businesses that are still boarded up. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting now, like, the city. A lot of people are moving out of New York City now. So it's interesting to see how the city might change, because I've lived here in New York for almost 30 years. And if you're an artist, or if you're like a aspiring artist, New York City is not for you anymore, because it's become so expensive. It's become so gentrified that I wonder if it's going to change now, because it seems like people who have money are moving to the suburbs now, or moving to other areas in New York State. So it's going to be interesting to see if the city will be friendly again to artists.
Well, in fact, isn't that why a lot of people went to Brooklyn?
Yeah, because it used to be and then
Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Detroit had a resurgence because it was cheap, so a lot of artist types moved there. Mm-hmm. Same thing, and it might be there might be a reverse trend now. New York might be more affordable.
Yeah, because you hear about, like, I mean,
the wealthy are moving out.
Well, I don't know, because, like, there's, like, been a lot of, like, nostalgia for New York City back in the 1970s and 80s. Even though there was higher crime back then, it was cheaper for artists. Mm-hmm. You can go and, you know, part-time work somewhere, and then the rest of the day you can just focus on your art, and the rents weren't, like, insane like they are now. So, yeah, I don't know, because when I first moved to Brooklyn back in the 90s, it was still a very kind of working class area, and now it's just, it's crazy, the rents here, they just keep rising and rising.
Yeah, and they don't have any rent freeze at all.
No.
Big problem in Canada, too, the availability of rental housing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real scarcity of rental housing now.
Hello. Thanks for listening to the Erratic Dispatches podcast. We'll be back shortly after a brief break.
Thanks for tuning in to this latest episode of the Erratic Dispatches podcast, featuring an interview with Canadian author Maggie Dwyer. I have two links located on the profile page for this podcast, in which you could check out Maggie's official website and also her Amazon page, in which you could purchase both What the Living Do and Misplaced Love short stories. There's also a contribution button located on my Anchor profile, and any kind of donation would be greatly appreciated, since I'm always striving to make my podcast better. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back soon with a new episode. Take care. Bye-bye.